This is the Mobile Tech Podcast, brought to you by worldpodcasts.com. Now here's your host, Tech Girl Miriam Joie.
Brought to you by Mint Mobile. Stay tuned for a special offer at the end of the show. Hi, and welcome to the Mobile Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Miriam Joie, and today is Thursday, March 23rd, 2023, and I'm here with Dean Schlingman of Hyundai. We're going to talk about some of the tech around the efficiency tech of the IONIQ 6, the new car that's going to be coming to your showrooms pretty soon. So, Dean, tell me about this.
All right.
We've got this beautiful cutaway here.
Yes.
And, you know, this is based on the EGMP platform.
It is.
A few things first, right? 800
yes.
volt architecture.
800 volt architecture. So this is definitely part of the EGMP family, so to speak, with the IONIQ 5, now the IONIQ 6. This will be the 2023 IONIQ 6.
Right. And so there's rear-wheel drive and all-wheel drive versions available.
Correct.
This is very similar in terms of the platform, the skateboard, right? As the IONIQ 5,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, this is a very overall modular system, so we can modify as needed to either go to a bigger battery, smaller battery, longer wheelbase, shorter, obviously, I guess even wider if we really needed to.
Right. And you have basically two battery configurations right now. There's a small pack for a limited range version that's
correct,
only rear-wheel drive, and then there's a larger pack for the all-wheel drive. Do you know roughly what sizes these are off the top
sure
of your head?
The standard size battery will be 53 kilowatt hours. The long-range battery will be 77 kilowatt hours, and that long-range is offered both in the rear-wheel drive configuration and the all-wheel drive configuration, with the rear-wheel drive being kind of the higher mileage or has the highest all-electric range that we offer at 361 miles.
So yeah, so that's actually pretty cool. As the motor is pretty much identical as what we've seen in the IONIQ 5 in terms of
yes
design and power output.
Yeah, a lot of the hardware was a carryover from IONIQ 5, and that's actually of benefit to the customer. We kind of figured out some of the roadblocks early on with the IONIQ 5, so the IONIQ 6 benefits from that, and maybe you know you'd see that as being either a smoother configuration or smoother integration, so to speak.
Awesome. So let's talk about efficiency, because this car is pretty amazing. You've got a range of 361 mile on the large battery pack rear-wheel drive model.
That's correct.
Now, it comes as its own set of tires, which are smaller than what we're going to see in the video here.
Right.
Here, you've got 20-inch tires right behind you. But besides the tires, what has been done in terms of aero to get this crazy drag coefficient of 0.22? And also, what has been done in terms of the drivetrain to optimize efficiency? Because this is
sure
a lot more range than the rear-wheel drive large battery IONIQ 5,
it
right?
It is, yeah. It's quite a bit longer. So from the aero standpoint, and I will preface this by saying I'm not necessarily an aero engineer. I'm more of a powertrain engineer. However,
no, but maybe you can point out some of the features
yes,
right on the
absolutely
car here.
So the IONIQ 6 has a drag coefficient of 0.22.
Yep.
Not the lowest in the industry, but not
it's
far off.
It's pretty damn close.
It's pretty close. It's pretty close. So on the front end of the vehicle, similar to what we might have seen on the IONIQ 5, we do have active aerodynamics going on. So in situations where we either need more or less cooling or heating, we can activate those. Those actually improve the front aero on the vehicle.
Right. You had those on the IONIQ 5 as well, the shutters, right?
We did.
But you've optimized the front end on this even more, correct?
Correct. And they weren't quite so prominent on the IONIQ 5. In this case, they're kind of right out there in the open, almost drawing attention, so to speak. So,
yeah, right.
Additionally, we have, and this was also something that was kind of a carryover from the IONIQ 5, but the wheel well package has a number of air skirts and diverters.
Yeah, I see you've got some aero effects here where the air can come through, right?
Exactly. Just trying to make sure that we're cutting the air wherever possible, making sure it's letting go of the vehicle as it slips through the air.
And then, the same thing in the rear, right?
Like correct.
In the back here, you've got a bunch of...
We do have some air management features. You can actually see this feature right here
on
the
body. Are these vortex generators? Is that what they're called?
Wow, you got me on that one. That's a great term. Yeah.
I mean, it's just to disturb the airflow
it's
a little bit, right?
It's to disturb airflow and make sure that as the air gets to the back of the car, it's actually letting go of the back of the car, which is kind of a weird concept, but air does want to
stick to the car.
It wants to stick to the car, and that's our worst enemy. That really does drag us down. And that's also why you'd end up seeing a lot of spoilers or air diverters on the back of vehicles. In this case, we actually have two.
Yeah.
And it is useful, and this isn't for going fast or, you know, setting some type of land speed record. They are completely functional as aero pieces for fuel economy and most efficiency. Again, just to try to get that air to let go of the vehicle.
I'm sorry, but they look super cool. It's like whale tail. They're pretty cool. You know, it's got some Porsche vibes, which you can't go wrong with.
Sure.
Talk about a little bit more of the drivetrain. So let's go to the front, yeah. And you can show me maybe this dog clutch system. So you basically can disconnect the motor completely, so you don't have to carry that inertia around, correct?
That's correct. So we recognize, and I think most would, that as soon as you put in another motor and drive system in a vehicle, you're adding not only weight, but parasitic losses as the vehicle is either rolling or driving. So our intent was to try to find efficiencies wherever possible, and we discovered by adding what we're kind of calling unofficially the dog clutch. I think we're calling it officially the disconnect actuator system. Uh-huh. It physically will disconnect tires from the motor and drive system. The idea, again, just to not spin the motor when it's unnecessary, because that is a parasitic loss.
Yeah.
By adding the dog clutch, we saw about a 6% fuel economy increase. And 6% is like a quantum leap. In our
huge
world,
yeah.
0.5% is a big deal.
You guys get awards internally.
Yeah,
for 6%
is big. So,
you know, you're able to manage that in software, right? So, like in eco mode, for example, you're pretty much rear wheel drive on this car.
Correct. Yeah.
And then you, in standard mode, you really only engage the all wheel drive, the front motor when needed.
Right.
Correct. And then in sport mode, you've got it on pretty much
it's
all
pretty
the time.
Pretty much on all the time and all.
And then
in
snow mode, of
mode.
Course, but it's a 50-50
yes.
split. Correct.
Exactly.
So, you know, again, to point out to the audience here, a lot of this is on the IONIQ 5 as well, right?
It is, yep.
But in this case, it makes a huge difference because you've got some aero optimizations on top of that.
Absolutely.
Right? So that's why we're getting that 361 mile EPA range on
correct.
The rear wheel drive model. So have you done any thermal optimizations in the drivetrain, the battery system, the motors compared to the IONIQ 5 here? Are there any like software improvements, or is it like hardware is essentially the same? You've just been
yeah.
tweaking software, right?
Hardware is the same. Software is very similar. We still incorporate, you know, preconditioning for the battery as you're approaching a fast charge.
Is that done through navigation, or are you actually like able to switch on the display to do it if you're using your Google Maps?
Yeah, that's
instead?
A great question. Right now, it's still activated through our onboard navigation. And basically, we have a model that looks at how far or what the distance is from where you are currently to where your target charge
yeah.
station is. We know what the battery temperature is. We know what the ambient temperatures are. And from that, we come up with a best estimate on, okay, we should start warming the battery approximately this far out so that when you get to the charge station, really, the entire reason for having that, or I guess the bulk of the reason for having that, is to optimize your charge events.
Right.
You know, we keep advertising 18 minutes, 18 minutes, 10 to 80%.
Yes.
In order to get there, your battery needs to be conditioned properly. And whether that's, you know, get it up to temperature or to get it down to temperature, we're looking at both of those sides. So when you reach there, you're going to be more likely to get that 18 minutes.
Your peak charge rate is about 235 kilowatt,
roughly.
Right?
Okay. Yep.
And so that's actually very, very good.
Yep.
There's been some tweaks in terms of software, but in terms of like the way the cooling is done through the battery pack and stuff and the motors, that hasn't changed since IONIQ 5, right? Because
yep.
it's the same platform.
Yep.
Let's wrap up quickly and talk about the V2L.
Oh, my
there
favorite.
I was going to say, there is an outlet here under the rear seats. And of course, this is a cutaway, so you have to imagine the rest of the car, folks. For those of you watching on Patreon, there's a video here, and I'm showing you the V2L adapter plugged into the charging port. I did a story about the V2L back in the day, like about a year ago after the IONIQ 5, and I think it's one of the greatest features of having an electric car.
It's pretty awesome. It adds a lot of functionality to the car that we didn't have before.
It's 1.9 kilowatt, right?
Correct.
Of power available.
Yep.
You said you've used a welder. You don't recommend it?
I didn't officially use a welder. making me nervous. But in any case, I was involved with some of the early testing for the V2L system, and it was important. I had a personal interest in this, but mm-hmm. it was also important within our department that we deliver a product and a capability that's real. It's right. not, hey, I can plug my cell phone in and it's fine. We wanted to, you know, if the power does go out in Texas again, we want to make sure that we've got a solution for that for some, you know, significant duration, and it is of value to the customer.
You mentioned you ran a fridge. Now, this is a much more like plausible scenario.
Exactly.
For like something like 5 days.
Yeah, I ran it for 5 days.
Some of the battery, but
yeah,
not a lot of it.
Yeah, maybe 30 or 40% from peak charge.
Right.
So I could have still gone for several more days. You know, that was one example. We've done, you know, coffee makers, water kettles, all the standard.
The blenders.
Even I ran, it was kind of an odd thing. This is back in the Ionic 5 days, but there was an electric barbecue that was used on a certain TV show. And you can do the research to figure that out. But I got a frantic phone call from my counterparts at HMA, Hyundai Motor America, saying, hey, will this work? So overnight, I had to Amazon myself an electric barbecue and plug it in and make sure that we could fry burgers, so it was kind of fun.
That's awesome. Well, listen, we should wrap up, but thanks for some insights into the Ionic 6. Very exciting product. And thanks for walking us through and, you know, pointing out some of the more nerdy things about the efficiency side and the drivetrain and the technology in the car. Thanks so much, Dean.
Awesome. Thanks.
And we're back, folks, with Maurice Kleiner of Counterpoint Research. And Maurice, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, Miriam. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being on the show. So we have one major announcement to cover this week, at least as far as phones go. And one major announcement, I think it's pretty major, about earbuds. And then one major announcement about AI. And I think the rest is all kind of leaks and rumors and interesting news tidbits, right?
Yeah, I mean, sounds all good.
So you saw the topics. I want to start with the Find X6 Pro, which is now official. That's the Oppo flagship. And I haven't played with one. They haven't sent me one yet. I'm still trying to get a review unit. So I don't have firsthand impressions, but I've heard from some of my colleagues who have used the phone and, you know, have used the Find X5 Pro last year and the previous Find X's. So I do have a point of reference. And of course, we've seen the specs and stuff now. So I can chime in with my thoughts, but what I really want to find out is what your thoughts are, and do you even have the device?
Yeah, so I don't have the device. I usually focus more on the North America market for my smartphone research. But what I think is really cool on the Find X 6 Pro is that 120x zoom, you know, just Samsung coming out with their 100x zoom and Moongate happening, and now, you know, we got 120x zoom on this device, kind of showing Samsung up related to that. I like it. The 350 megapixel cameras that it has, the Mary Silicon X neural processing unit that it has. It's really cool. It's a really cool spec device. Definitely a flagship. You know, you have the wired and wireless charging. I know you love to see that. And yeah, that like sensor, the 1-inch sensor, I believe right now it's on a Vivo X90 and a Xiaomi 13 that's coming.
That's correct. Yeah. So on the Vivo X90 Pro and X90 Pro Plus, which are the Dimensity and Snapdragon versions respectively, there's some other differences of the cameras, but I believe both of the main sensors are the 989. And then, of course, we have the Xiaomi 13 Pro. As you mentioned, but also last year's Xiaomi 12S Ultra had that sensor exclusively in China. So, you know, they kind of got first grabs, first dibs, whatever on it early on last summer with that 12S Ultra. And then, you know, now it's kind of available to everyone, right. I guess. And, you know, frankly, that's kind of the showstopper in a way, right? Like that's the thing that makes this phone kind of stand out. I mean, there's other things, obviously, but I'm super excited to try it out. How do you feel about it? Do you think this is a big step forward, or do you think for the average consumer, it doesn't really matter? Like, how do you think they're going to position this? Because they're not selling it in the West yet.
Yeah, I mean, on the West part, I asked some of my other colleagues about that. It's going to be interesting how Oppo's positioned just in China versus, you know, outside of China. Because in Europe, really, Oppo had a lot of marketing spend. You know, they sponsored football, soccer. They had a lot of like marketing in that sense there. And they didn't, I don't think, saw a big return on investment in terms of gaining market share and stuff like that. So them maybe staying in China is, you know, for them just like trying to pull back and kind of refocus with this device. And I think it, you know, it's a really good device. A lot of stuff, I mean, we've seen with a lot of these different smartphones, it's all just incremental, you know, innovations and increases. So not a lot different, but definitely, you know, one of those standout contenders, I think, for 2023 so far.
So I agree. I mean, I think this is one of the more interesting phones of the year so far, but I think there's a more of a meta kind of question here. Do you, this pulling back that you're talking about, I feel that's happening. I feel that the Chinese makers are not necessarily wanting us to get all this stuff as much as before. Like every Find X ever made has made it to Europe and to other markets, North America. And North America, of course, not. But the point is that this seems weird to me because last year, the Find X5 Pro, they made a China version, China-only version. Actually, they sold two versions, but the China-only version was a very decontented version. It had, it looked the same, but it had a Dimensity 9000, not a big deal. Not, that's not a big decontenting, but it also had a lesser camera system. It didn't have the Hasselblad branding and features. And while it was the same main sensor, it did not have the in-body stabilization, the sensor shift. It had just regular OIS instead. And, you know, it had different f-stop on the main. So the rest of the specs were the same, the ultra-wide and the portrait lens. But it was really interesting to me that they did that. Yet, this year, there's only one, and it's a Snapdragon one, and it's so far only coming to China. Do you think they're just going to, like, 3 months from now, launch it in the West, or do you think this is just going to stay like that? What's your kind of feelers around that right now?
I think my feeling is that it might stay in China for now. The overall market that we're seeing, so I cover a lot of, you know, the smartphone sales aspect, the market
shares. That's kind of why I'm asking you, like, do you think they're pulling back? Because that's kind of it feels like to me.
That's what I'm seeing, because the overall market right now is down. You know, I think for the first half of this year, all the OEMs are not really seeing a lot of growth, not really seeing a lot of opportunity. And even, you know, flagship sales, you know, not as strong. In the US, at least, you know, the carriers are needing to push a lot with promotions and stuff to get anything going right now.
But it kind of makes sense because we've kind of had a consolidation of the market, right? We kind of have a bit of a steady state now where if you have a phone, like say you have an S21 Ultra, it's 2 years old, it's still a really solid and relevant phone.
Right.
Especially with the software update set that Samsung keeps pushing out. So do you bother even? Like I used to say, like for me, of course, and people like you and us, you know, the audience here that is like early adopter tech savvy folks, we're going to upgrade every 6 months, a year, 2 years at most, depending on our budget. And we're going to save our pennies to get the best we can. But I think that the average person used to be pretty much on a 2 year cycle. Like they didn't have to think about it, but now they're starting to think about it, right? I think there are some people who are going to keep their phones more than 2 years now.
Well, that's the thing. Like, at least here in the US, we've seen some of the replacement rate cycles go up to 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, something like that, years so far.
Wow.
So it really has elongated. You know, people that have gone on to like an S23 right now are coming from like an S9, something like that, you know, S8, S9. And so it's people holding onto these devices for longer. These devices are made to last longer. You know, Samsung really pushing it as well with the, 4 years of OS updates and 5 years of security, which, you know, this phone has as well. So they're really making it for the long run and essentially also future-proofing it with, you know, putting stuff like Wi-Fi 7 in the devices and things like that. So, yeah, it's really now a longer game, I think, for a lot of these smartphone manufacturers that, you know, don't have that quick sales cycle anymore.
Yeah. And do you get a feel or a sense for what's happening in the European market at all?
In the European market, that's not really my specialty there, but essentially a lot of, it depends where in Europe you're talking about, right? So with the Russia-Ukraine conflict,
right,
there's a lot going on there, and Apple pulling out, Samsung pulling out of those markets. So the Eastern European market in that sense has dropped a lot because of that. Western Europe, you know, still political tensions, or rather inflation, you know, people paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars for their gas and electricity bills. So things like that have not been in favor of consumers spending a lot in terms of their devices, right, which essentially means, you know, less sales of these high-end devices, which are not as subsidized as they are here in the US right now. You know?
Yeah, and that's what I thought, you know, I mean, that's the feeling I get as well. So they're struggling in a different way though, yeah, but I bet you their update cycles are also getting longer because, yeah, of it. But back on the phone, let's talk about the camera system, because it's a triple 50 megapixel system. So very similar on paper, at least, to the Xiaomi 13 Pro, which is also a triple 50 megapixel system. And I have that phone, the 13 Pro, and that one is sold in the West and in Europe and other parts of the world. Not North America, of course, but it is available. And so it's interesting that Xiaomi is continuing, whereas Oppo might be pulling back. And Vivo is certainly pulling back because they're only making the Dimensity version available, yeah, in Europe. And that's spec'd slightly differently camera-wise, so you're not getting the best of the best. But in terms of this phone, the Find X6 Pro here, so the big 989 is a, you know, this sensor is incredible. It's a one-inch, yeah, type sensor, meaning that if you had a one-inch tube, you could fit the rectangle inside the one-inch diameter. That's what a one-inch means, in case folks are not aware yet. So it's actually smaller than one-inch diagonal. Yeah. So 1.6 micron pixels, pixel bins 4:1. So that's huge. That's some seriously large pixels, right?
Yeah.
3.2 microns, and then laser autofocus, phase detect autofocus, optical image stabilization. Interestingly, I haven't seen Oppo mention anything about in-body stabilization, or I assume this is standard OIS, which is interesting that they went back on that. I mean, I don't personally don't mind, because I didn't think it added that much to the experience last year, but it's interesting that they kind of pioneered this and pulled back in the same way, actually, as they pioneered the folded lens, the, you know, periscope telephoto. Yeah. And then they kind of dropped it for after the Find X2 Pro, the 3 and the 5 didn't have it. And now it's back here. And so those two other sensors, the telephoto, which is folded periscope, and the ultra wide, are both the same sensor, which is an IMX870, I believe.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So. Pull that down.
And but anyway, the point is that these are 1/1.56 inch sensors. So they're about as big as.
Oh, 890. It's an 890.
890?
Okay. That's what it was, yeah.
Thank you. IMX 890. So these are about as big as the sensor in like a Galaxy S23 Ultra, the 200 megapixel, like maybe possibly even bigger. I'm not sure. They're around, they're very big. Yeah. 1 micron pixels, so you get 2 microns at 4:1 pixel binning. Interestingly, both have OIS. The ultra wide has OIS, which I haven't seen in a while, and I think that's because the ultra wide doubles as a macro. So it has autofocus on the macro, PDAF, phase detect. So this is one hell of an ultra wide. Now there is a negative here. F/2.2 is pretty standard for ultra wide, but 110 degree field of view is kind of narrow for an ultra wide, actually. Most of them are on 118, 120. So I guess that's a sacrifice I had to make by having to put a specialized lens on top of that large sensor, right?
Right. What do you think of the Hasselblad branding that they have on there?
You know, I think it's about the color sign still only.
Yeah.
Let me get back to you and finish about the telephoto, because there's something interesting here. So the specs say that this is a 3x telephoto, but it's really a 2.8x telephoto, and it's got OIS and phase detect autofocus and the same IMX890 sensor, but it can basically do 3x zoom. By default, it's 3x is what they call it, but then it has a 6x lossless because it says sensor zooming, right? Like takes the crop the middle of the sensor. So you lose the pixel binning, but you now have one micron sensors at 12 megapixels in the center, which is three times bigger. So it's 6X or whatever. And then it also does 2X on the main sensor. So you basically get, you know, four lossless levels, right? Like 1X, 2X, 3X, 6X. And that's pretty cool because nobody else is doing that right now. Lots of people are doing 2X lossless, like Apple, like which phone did I review recently that did that? Whole bunch of them. But anyway, it's pretty common these days, but not on the, you know, on the telephoto. Of course, the Pixel does that as well. Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking about. And I think this camera system is interesting. So back to the Hasselblad. So here's my problem with this. I was willing to play along with the Hasselblad game that Oppo and OnePlus have had or are still having. But I feel like right now it's a little, how can I put it? I think that Oppo's color science and imaging pipeline at the high end is very good. And it was very good back in the even the Find X2 days when it didn't have the Hasselblad banding. All we've really gained is, you know, a certain taste, a certain flavor of imaging. Like, I don't think that the Hasselblad makes this branding, makes this phone better than
does
other
it make
Oppo
sense
phones?
For Oppo, like, is the question, right? I think, like, it makes sense for OnePlus, I think, but...
For Oppo, it's a harder sell, yeah.
Right.
I agree. But I feel that to me, it's just really about the color science, and it does make a difference if you like that flavor. Yep. But I was hoping to see more in the same way as when Huawei was working with Leica, we got to see more. And right now, Xiaomi 13 Pro and, of course, the 12S Ultra before that were also Leica branded, but it's really, again, more about the color science. Whereas I think with Huawei, there was actually some input from Leica on the spec of the lenses and some other tricks. And, you know, Zeiss has a partnership with Vivo. And on that partnership, they actually also have like T-Star coding and stuff like that that they apply that is hardware optimized, basically, in addition to the color science. So I think it's, and Sony as well with the Zeiss stuff. So I think it's interesting that Hasselblad so far has been more of a marketing exercise, although the color science is really nice. I like to have the option. But I'm also vexed. I have to point out that, and I've said that a few times, that I don't understand. This is purely marketing and it pisses me off. The Oppo Find N2 Flip, their flip phone, the one that looks like a Z Flip, has Hasselblad branding and has a decent enough camera system on hardware, on paper, except for one thing. It doesn't have OIS. And if I was Hasselblad, that would be a no-no. Like, I would be like, look, you can put your branding on anything you want, but we have some minimum viable product kind of requirements here about what the hardware needs to do. And no OIS to me with the Hasselblad brand is basically giving me a middle finger and saying, oh, this is purely marketing. Now, does the phone take bad pictures? No, it's fine. But it could be better. Obviously, it has to keep the shutter open longer in low light, and then you get blur. So, any thoughts on that?
I think I agree with most of what you said there. The Hasselblad partnership to me is so interesting too. Like, didn't they have like an agreement only for 3 years or 5 years too on that? So
yeah, it's like a limited time.
Yeah.
So I can't remember how long, but
all that will go away too. So to me, it's also a little bit about like, you know, consistency of a device and like making sure that, you know, you have kind of a progression with it and not just like, you know, having Hasselblad landing on one thing and then not in the next generation of a device. So, but I mean, in terms of the camera itself, you know, it's here in the US, we don't get those devices. So like, it's so hard for me to even, you know, get my hands on them and see how they operate. But having such like a triple camera, 50 megapixel camera setup, I think we see more of like a 50 megapixel being a standard for premium devices at the moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing is like, where do you go from there? Right.
Like, well, I think, okay, so I have some ideas, but I see your point. I agree with you. I think 50 seems to be the sweet spot, especially at the higher end. for a while it was 4864, never yeah. really took off. I mean, it existed, but the results were always kind of like, do you really need a 16 megapixel, you know, result? Probably not. 12, you know, anywhere between 8 and 12 final resolution seems to be the sweet spot. And 12 is obviously seems to be kind of like what we've fallen back on. 12 with 48 and 12.5 technically with 50. But I have some hopes about what computational photography and larger pixel counts can do. And we're starting to see mm-hmm. a glimpse of that of the Galaxy S23 Ultra. Things like, you know, when you can pixel build 9:1 or 16:1, in this case, you can start doing things like having lossless zoom at two different levels, right? Of course, you lose the ability to pixel bin, but the Galaxy S23 Ultra lets you zoom in 2x, and that's 4:1 binning.
Right.
And then it lets you zoom again to, you know, I think, what, 3 or 4x or whatever it is, and technically it doesn't use that because now it has a telephoto that's dedicated. But you could theoretically, and I think, which phone was it? Xiaomi had a phone with a 200 megapixel sensor. Oh, yeah, the Xiaomi 11T Pro last fall. And I tested that. And if you zoomed in further, it would crop the microscopic 0.6 micron pixels for a 12 megapixel image. So you were very light deficient. But if you had enough light, you could zoom losslessly, like at 4x, you know? So is that kind of interesting? I think there's some things to be said here. Although binning pixels is still challenging because you have to read a lot more pixels. So like your data throughput and your computational throughput is really, really high.
Right.
And that means you're using up more energy on the battery, on the processor. So there are some compromises, but I do feel like 108 might stick around for a little longer, but I feel like we're going to settle on 200. I'm starting to see 200 coming on some mid-range phones from China that are inbound that I can't talk about yet. And these are phones that are $300 with 200 megapixel sensors. So I'm like, whoa, like if that's possible, I'll give you another example, a Realme 10 series. Realme 10 Pro and 10 Pro Plus have a 108 megapixel sensor, and it can losslessly zoom to 3x by doing the cropping thing again.
Right.
And it looks so good. In enough light, you're getting incredibly crisp 3x photos at 12 megapixels. But you're like, wow, this is a thing. Like, I think that ISPs are going to come around to start supporting these features more natively. And it might be a win, especially in the mid-range segment where you want the image quality, but you might not be able to put all the lenses, you know, and the sensors
right.
on there
yeah.
for cost reasons. So, you
and,
know.
And it certainly, like, could be more of a differentiator. I mean, at least, you know, again, in the U.S. market, that, like, 300 to 600 price range segment is kind of like a dead zone. You know, most OEMs go, like, either cheaper or more expensive. So having something, you know, that could go and make it more exciting in that space can be really be a value driver for, I think, people.
100%.
Yeah.
So let's quickly rapid fire through some of the other specs. This is a proper freaking flagship. It makes me so happy. I love the industrial design, especially the two-tone with the vegan leather yep. and the frosted glass, and then the satin finished metal frame. Of course, the metal glass vegan leather. These are the camera, like the camera bump, with a little orange dot, even though, you know, there's no lens you can mount on it. It kind of like has that, you know, it kind of skeuomorphs the idea of a removable lens with a little red yeah. dot. I think there's little design touches there that are really cool. How do you feel about it?
I think just when you talked about design touches, I just noticed it had an IR blaster in there as well.
Yeah, pretty common on a lot of Chinese phones. Lets you control your mini split
right.
or air conditioner or TV or whatever. Yeah,
and it's just something that I don't see that often anymore. So it's just like, oh,
it's nice.
I wish I had them here more.
Yeah, I
US
agree.
Devices, yeah.
Yeah, Samsung, get on that. Apple's never going to do it. So you know,
No.
Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, lots of RAM, lots of storage. It's got, you know, DDR5X, it's got UFS 4.0. It's got the whole shebang. The display is pretty much the same as last year, except for one thing. Peak brightness of 2,500 nits, the super brightest bright of any display we've yeah ever seen. Holy crap. Wow. That's basically all I have to say.
Yeah, it's crazy. Amazing.
You look at this display and it's just crazy. It's Quad HD, 6.82 inches, 510 pixel per inch. Remember when we barely reached like Retina, like basically anything over 300, like a few yeah years back? And now it's just like 500. Like, wow. I mean, I know this is not new, but people who say there hasn't been any progress in phones, come on, look at these specs. This is just ridiculous. The battery is 5,000 milliamp hours, which, I mean, again, we don't see 5,000 usually paired with such fast charging. Usually we see like 4,500 or 4,800. This is 100 watt wired, like the OnePlus 11. It's 50 watt wireless. Amazing. I'm happy. I'm on board. Has everything I need. I mean, honestly, I can't wait to get a review on it. I mean, they keep pestering Apple, but... Wi-Fi 7. Not all 8 Gen 2 phones have Wi-Fi 7, so...
Right.
Not that you need that today, but...
you don't. Not a lot of Wi-Fi 7 out there right now.
Not much at all. Also, the front camera, the 32 megapixel, but it's pretty meh. It doesn't have autofocus. Oh, yes, it does. Autofocus, interesting, but no OIS, obviously. Still, though, 0.8 microns. I wonder if it pixel bins down to 8 from 32. 4-to-1, because that would help, because a 0.8 micron with an f over 2.4 lens is going to be a little painful. But you know what bothers me about this here? And this has been going on with a lot of Xiaomi and BBK Group phones. Look at the maximum video recording on it.
Oh, right. Yeah, it can't...
Can't do 4K.
Yeah, can't do 4K. That's right.
Like, Apple and Samsung almost do 4K on every phone. Like, how is it that, is this still a problem? Like, why selfies? I mean, I'm not a huge selfie person, but why is it that selfies are so neglected? I don't get it.
Right. Yeah. It's a lot of times there's almost no focus on it too. In a lot of these, press releases or videos that we're seeing about them.
Yeah.
We mentioned
stereo speakers, of course. I mean, it's got everything, you know, speaking of stereo speakers, I've been playing with the Realme GT3, you know, the 240-watt phone. Mm-hmm. I've talked about it on the podcast a few times. Yesterday, I was, you know, doing my hair. I like to shave the sides of my hair myself. And I fire up one of my review phones and use the speakers. That's a great opportunity to, like, test the speakers in a phone I'm reviewing. Right. So I used the Realme for that yesterday. And holy crap, that sounded good. Like, you know, it's never going to sound as good as a proper speaker, but... they're getting really good, even at the, you know, lower end of the flagship level now, because the Realme GT3 is on the more affordable end of things. So that tells me BBK Group is doing something right with their phones, with audio. Because, I mean, I don't remember the OnePlus 11 sounding quite that good. I mean, probably close. But I wonder if that Realme is better or worse than the Oppo. Be interesting to find out when I get a review. It's little things like that that kind of sometimes blow you away. You're like, wait, what?
know? Yeah, I mean, for us, it's like those little things that we try to find to eke out, you know, a good review or...
Yeah, you get to a point where you're like, what could I nitpick on this time?
Exactly.
Well, let's move on to some other topics. The Ear 2 are out from Nothing. I'm going to link to the Verge's review, just like I linked to the... Verge's Oppo Find X6 Pro announcement. We're probably going to start seeing some reviews of the Oppo soon, but the reviews for the Nothing Ear 2 are out, and the consensus seems to be pretty much the same as last year, $50 more because of inflation. So they launched at $100, the Ear 1, and then they went up to $130, I think. Now they're $150 for the Ear 2. But everybody seems to agree that it's pretty much the same with slightly better ANC and slightly better sound quality. And I like the Ear 1, so I think I'm going to be very happy when I get my review units of the Ear 2.
Short and sweet. You know, I think they did some work, I think, on the size of the case, too. It's a little bit smaller and thinner. And yeah, it's competitive at one. Here's my thing with TWS. I don't like buying expensive TWS because I tend to lose mine a lot. So something under $200, $100 to $150, something like that, to me, it's like a sweet spot of, you know, being able to, you know, eat the cost if I lose it and get a new one or something like that. So I think it's still priced right, even though it's a little bit more expensive.
Yeah, you know, I worked in video games doing audio for years, so I'm a bit of an audiophile. I hate using that word because I'm not that kind of person, but I am a bit picky about my audio. And I'm one of those people who likes a very flat, neutral frequency response. You know, a lot of, especially younger people today, are just used to very bassy music. But, you know, if you're in a recording studio and you use studio headphones or any good, well-calibrated, your Sonys, or like I'm using Sonys here that are, I'm using them wired, but they're my noise canceling for flying because I'm on a trip right now. But I have Beyer Dynamic DT990 Pro, usually that's what I use. Anyway, that's the kind of sound I like. And I can definitely give the audience here some recommendations. If you don't want to spend a lot of money and still want to get a good experience, still want to get ANC, there are some good choices, even under $100. My go-tos right now for affordable, good enough ANC, good sound quality, decent battery life. The only thing you give up is wireless charging, but whatever, are the $49 Realme Buds 2, available on Amazon. Unbelievably great value. But strangely, the Realme Buds 3, the successor, not so good. Like, they're priced right, but they don't sound as good. The Ear 1 and Ear 2, I assume, based on what I'm reading, will probably sound similar. I like the Ear 1. I like also the Ear Stick, even though they don't have ANC. The current OnePlus Buds Pro 2, I believe they're called, if EQ'd properly in the app, so that the EQ is saved in the earbuds, are also really good. By default, they're bass heavy, but you can fix that. What are my other go-tos? Sony Link Buds S. Of course, there's the WF series, which are really high-end, but I find they're a bit bulky and they sound great. They're like, Sony's are the best in my opinion still. But if you can just get 90% of the sound quality and a much more friendly user experience because of weight and size, the Link Buds S are really great, in my opinion. Again, a bit of EQ needed, but because it can save the EQ setting in the earbuds, it doesn't matter what you pair it with, it stays, the sound profile stays with you, which is great. TCL makes some really good earbuds. The Move Audio S600. See, there you go. We did a mini review of the best earbuds, and these are ranging from $49 all the way to like $300.
It's true. I think you picked some good ones there.
I mean, I didn't mention Apple and Samsung, although I like their stuff. I think the AirPods Pro version 2 are really good.
Right.
Wasn't as keen on the version 1, but the version 2. The Samsung Buds, most of them are pretty solid, again, with a bit of EQing. But honestly, I'm like, there are so many other choices out there. Why the hell wouldn't you try out the rest of the stuff?
Right.
Do you have a favorite?
I used to rock the Samsung Buds. Did that for
which ones?
The Buds 2 Pro, I think.
Okay.
I had, but they I lost them after like 4 months, and then after that I was on an airplane, long flight, fell out of my pants, and then just forgot about them. So ever since then, I've stayed away from a lot of TWS, but more recently I've been, I got the new OnePlus Buds Pro 2.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying those, and I mean, I've been happy with those, honestly.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
Super, like, it's nothing special, but it's one thing that I would like to see more of, actually, is like the, I forget what it's called, like the passive noise. So when you can hear like the outside external
transparency.
Yeah, transparency mode. Yeah.
Yeah.
That I think, you know, if you can convince me that, for a phone or for a TWS for $150 that has, you know, more better transparency mode, I'd go for that.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. The Realme's have transparency, but it's okay. It's not great, but it's $49. So whatever, you can lose them every week, basically. It's a joke. It's like having, like, you know, if you have a coffee budget and you go out for one coffee a day in San Francisco, that's probably the price of your earbuds for a week there. Look, I don't use TWSs very much. I use them when I'm walking outside, when I'm running errands and walking in the city. That's when I use them. I use them when I'm waiting at the airport or something.
Right.
But if I'm on an airplane, it's these.
Oh,
it's
the Sony. Yeah.
Yeah, I have both the XM4s and the XM5s. These are the 4s because they fold. I like them a little better, even though they're older ones. And, you know, at home when I'm recording in the studio, I use open back DT990 Pros. They're very comfortable. And it's quiet enough in the studio. I don't need to worry about open back, and nobody, it's not going to bother anybody. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm at with my when listening stuff. But the earbuds, I'm finding that I'm walking a lot more than now that I live half of my time in Vancouver in a part of the city that's very walkable. And I'm walking more, so I'm using TWSs more just because they're more convenient and more comfortable when I find for walking at least.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I kind of liked using them when I'm biking too, especially.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think they have their place. I honestly, for the most part, since I have a lot of like calls I need to do with clients sometimes, old and reliable wired earbuds, like still can't beat it for some of this.
So for phone calls on my phone, I use a pair of old OnePlus USB type C buds.
Yeah.
The bullets. Because it's not for sound quality. It's mostly for zero latency, zero battery charging, zero connectivity issues. Plug it into the port and I can make a phone call. And the microphone sounds really clear. They can hear me really well. Awesome. Done. Now, when I'm doing like this right now, we're on Skype talking to each other. If I'm doing a Zoom call, I use my wired headphones and use generally the built-in mic in my laptop because I have a MacBook Air and it's very good.
Yeah.
Or at studio, I just use the studio mic that I have set up. But it's interesting because I absolutely, for calls, will not use my true wireless earbuds. So, like, unless I'm outside and walking and my spouse calls me and wants, hey, can you get some milk while you're out there? And I'll say yes. That's the only time that I actually use the TWSs for voice calls. For me, it's purely a musical or podcasting experience on the go.
Right. Yeah. It's
basically. So speaking of earbuds, I'm going to lump this in here because we're talking about earbuds. I mentioned how I like the Sonys. So Sony's had the WF series, which are the earbuds, and the WH series, which are the headphones. For those of you on Patreon watching the video right now, those are the ones I'm wearing, the WH series. I've got the XM4s. There's an XM5 that doesn't fold, as I just mentioned. But the WF series is their really high-end earbuds that are incredible. The WF M4s, the M4s are incredible. And the M5s are rumored now. We're seeing some leaks. And, you know, there's really no surprises here. I just wanted to mention it. For those of you who are into your high-end TWSs and are willing to drop whatever the 300 or whatever it's going to be for those, you know, warm up your wallets because I'm sure these things are going to rock.
Yeah, I mean, Sony, I think they have like the best noise-canceling, active noise-canceling TWS that's available. So, you know, I expect something better than the M4. But one thing I wanted to mention with this is because I was literally debating on the M4 or the Buds 2 Pro from Samsung. And I went with the Samsung ones because the Sony ones protruded from my ear a little bit too much.
Exactly. They're too big and too heavy and too uncomfortable, generally speaking.
Yeah.
This is the thing I'm hoping they will fix here is that I cannot, like, the reason I went to the Link Buds S, which are cheaper, but it's because they're smaller, lighter, and more comfortable to wear. But if they can make the XM5s as comfortable and as convenient, oh my God, I am so going to be there.
Yeah, I agree. That might be my next high-end purchase that I might lose in 4 months.
Oh, don't do that. Chain it to yourself.
I know.
Okay, we got a whole bunch more leaks and rumors that are interesting. I'm just going to kind of rapid fire through these because, again, they're leaks and rumors. So it's just more like informative, and I want to give you some of my thoughts, folks. There's a couple of Pixel 8 related leaks and rumors. There's a design of the Pixel 8 has leaked finally. We saw the design of the Pixel 8 Pro last week, and we mentioned that on the show. I'm only putting it out there because of one thing that I'm not liking in this design trend we're seeing for both the 8 and the 8 Pro, but also for the Fold, is this rounded corner business that Google seems to be going. I'm sorry, but I really like my, you know, squared off, you know, yeah, this thing right here. You know, that's what I like. I like the fact that this looks more like a Galaxy S23 Ultra, my Pixel 7 Pro, that it has that squarish design. And I'm not a big fan of those rounded corners that we're seeing in those renders or in those photos or whatever those leaks are. What is your take? I know I'm being fickle here, but...
Yeah, and to me, I actually like the rounded corners a little bit more, you know, just in terms of longevity and, like, impact, like... I think the rounded corner is a little bit easier if you drop them. Yeah, but and otherwise it doesn't super matter to me. I'd like more that, you know, they're continuing with that the Star Trek guy, you know, the visor.
I like that better too. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting. Like, I'm not mad about it, but because I'm liking that they're going to flat screens across the board, which is good. But I kind of wish it was a little squarer. Like, this is a little too rounded. It kind of reminds me too much of Samsung and Apple. I'm not sure I'm up for that. The reason I have a Pixel is to be different. No, the reason I have a Pixel is because it's the best phone, period, for me at least. Okay, so then there's some talk about the Pixel 8 Pro implementing what we usually call sensor fusion, which is the fusing in the ISP of the signal from multiple cameras to create an image. Right now, Huawei was kind of the leader in this. They did it starting with the P20 Pro, I believe, the P20 series. So they were actually, even before that, I think the P9, P10 series did blending between the black and white sensor and the color sensor as well. But the idea is that in the case of like a monochrome and a color sensor, you pick the light information from the black and white and the color information from the color sensor, and you blend the two and you get better dynamic range, right? For example. But with the 20 Pro and the 30 Pro and the 40 Pro and the 50 Pro, what they did, and Honor's doing this as well with the Magic 4 Pro and the Magic 5 Pro, is that, you know, when you're zooming in, you start taking data from the telephoto, you start taking data from the ultra wide, and you start kind of like piecemealing the thing to get the better photo. Now, that's getting really crazy computationally, but it's a thing. And if done right, like Huawei did it, it's very powerful. It lets you, for example, like P40 Pro Plus, right? The first phone before the Galaxy that had two telephotos, the 3X and a 10X. Let's all remember, that was the first that did the two telephoto thing. It only had 10 megapixel telephoto, no, actually 8 megapixel telephoto sensors, 8 3X and 8 10X. Yet it outputted, I think, 10 megapixel images. And because what it did is it used the main sensor, and then the middle of it is higher resolution, basically. But you don't really notice because of the way they computed the whole thing together. It's kind of incredible, honestly. And it gives you results that you don't expect from an 8 megapixel, because they're not just from the 8 megapixel. And so now there's rumors that we're going to see some sensor fusion like this on the Pixel 8 Pro. And as far as I know right now, Google hasn't done any pure sensor fusion yet. So exciting if it's true.
Yeah. I think to me, it's like a continuation of their, you know, their super res zoom, what they have.
Exactly.
And it's just for night photography, which, you know, Google does really great night photography. So it makes sense that it would continue on with that, you know, for the night photography stuff.
Yeah, I'm just excited because I love imaging on phones, and I'm like, I want Google to do even cooler stuff, especially since I generally daily a Pixel. So,
yeah,
this is, if it's true, this is good news. You know, I mentioned the Oppo Find N2 Flip earlier and how we all love it because it's got a larger cover display. Despite not having OIS on the main sensor, despite not having wireless charging, these are things that are worse than the Samsung equivalent, the Z Flip 4. But rumors are that the Z Flip 5 that's coming is going to have an even bigger cover display at 3.4 inches than the Oppo. And I'm on board. Now that I've used the Oppo extensively for a while, I don't want to go back to a small cover display. Mm. Even though the Oppo doesn't really do that much more with its cover display than the Samsung phone does, like there is room for Oppo to do a little more. In fact, I think somebody just published an app that lets you repurpose the front screen on the Oppo and lets you actually run full apps on the front screen. Because think about it, that front screen on the Oppo, 3.1 inches or whatever, is the same size as the original HTC T-Mobile G1.
Right, yeah.
Crazy, right?
That used to be what we operated on for...
I can't believe we used the keyboard on that. Like, I have such a hard time using the keyboard on a... like a smaller than 6-inch phone right now. Never mind like a 3.2 inch.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm excited about this simply because I want more real estate on that front thing. Even if it doesn't really use it very well, it's nice to have lots of white space and it just feels comfortable. It feels nice, you know, especially when it's not a fold that unfolds into like a huge tablet. So you know that the best you're going to get is unfolded as 6.8 inch phone experience. So yeah. You're excited about that or you're like, meh?
I mean, it's, I haven't seen that many use cases, honestly, for, you know, the front Z Flip display. So, you know, I saw someone like run Pokemon on it or something, which to me was interesting to see just like how you can kind of use that screen, as you said, as even running full apps and stuff.
Like, but, I don't want to run full apps, to be clear. I think that's too much. But I want to see a little more. Like, I'll give you an example. Yeah. Right now on Samsung, it's very, you can do very little. But notifications on Oppo, there's lots of room for them to expand the notifications a bit more, and they're not doing that. So this tells me Samsung will do it right. And more importantly, I don't know. I've have you used the Razer, the, you know, the reboot?
Yeah, I have.
It does a much better use of its real estate for the display, you know? And that's kind of what I'm hoping Samsung can achieve here. That's my hope, basically.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're really seeing these phones take up more, more people are buying them, right? And so there's more incentive also for developers and stuff to get into it, to be able to, you know, have more than, or to be able to program stuff on these, you know, different size screens, really, that require different software support, right? So
yeah, it's true.
That really is like the other piece too, that we really need to, the adoption piece really will help also drive a little, this a little tweaking a little bit more.
Like, I feel like Google had a thing going with the cards they had in the Discover, you know, the Google Now back in the days. Mm-hmm. Like basically it's like, think of it as a smartwatch, but the cover screen is your smartwatch. So a similar user experience to that is kind of what I think would be the sweet spot.
Yeah.
You know, but let's see how it develops. Also, this is an interesting one. So I've been avoiding this rumor because iPhone rumors, I generally don't even go into until August or something. But the haptic buttons leak. Now it's a leak, no longer a rumor, that they were going to replace the volume rocker and the power lock key and even the mute switch with essentially, like they did with their trackpads and they've done with the home button on the iPhone 7 and onward, where it's there, it's a separate piece, but it doesn't have any mechanical switch underneath. Yeah, it's just pressure. It's and it uses a haptic engine to give you feedback. I think Apple can pull this off. I think they can totally pull it off. And I think the reason they're replacing the mute switch with a mute haptic fake button is because you can, if you, they'll give you different feedback on whether it's on or off. Now you won't have the visible feedback anymore, which I think is a bummer because, you know, right now, if you slide it, you see the little, see the little red, but I'm feeling like they're going to give you such a nice little knock, knock or whatever, when you have it in mute, that you'll know you have it in mute.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this and is it a generational thing? You know, is Apple targeting like the millennials and younger with this type of a design rather than like
maybe? You know, I think they're just saving themselves the moving parts. Basically,
I mean, the haptic
engine is in there. It has to be for vibration and everything else. So why not like replace? You still, I think there's still going to be separate parts. It's not like it's not going to be like the HTC 11, which had those that kind of software-based power lock key and volume buttons, mm-hmm. but didn't have had a big delay in the haptics and it didn't work very well. And they were physically molded inside the frame. I think this is actually still going to be a separate piece, kind of like the trackpads on the Macs are still a separate piece of glass. It just doesn't move. It's just kind of fixed in place. But when you push on it, you get the impression that it's moving. I think that's what we're going to get.
Yeah, I think that'd be really sweet. Did you try the haptic feedback on the OnePlus 11 that they had on there?
Yeah, yeah.
So like that's kind of like what it reminded me of in a way.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Just
yeah, I think you can go very far with haptics, and I think not enough companies are exploring it. Yet some of the phones like that Oppo that we've mentioned earlier, the Find X6 Pro, based on my previous experience with 5X5 Pro, that's gotta be the haptic engine on that thing is gonna be super hot. So I think that they could do it on Android as well. It's just that nobody's gonna do it first, and Apple's gonna show you how to do it right. It's a matter of getting the latency right. Like it really has to be indistinguishable from the real thing. And Apple's done it twice properly now with the home button and the trackpads. So I'm actually excited about this one, even though I'm gonna miss the physically visible red area on the mute switch.
Yeah, I think a lot of people won't need to get used to it if that happens. So, see.
One last kind of newsy, rumory, leaky thing is a Pebble might be coming back as a brand. Now, disclaimer, I used to work for Pebble. I was the head of communications at Pebble in the early days. Yeah. I was responsible for a lot of the marketing and media relations and analyst relations. So, you know, they're very fond to my heart, but I also left because I could see that we didn't have a strategy to live up against the Apple Watch. And I didn't want to be the one having to field communications for that. So I'm excited that the team behind the original Pebble, Eric Majikovsky, and some of the other people from the team are supposedly getting together to make a mini Android flagship or mini Android high spec phone. To kind of mimic the iPhone 13 mini, but in an Android, and are going to crowdfund it. And you go, guys. Awesome. I think it's cool. I saw that today and I was like, we got a Shemesha. What's your take on this thing?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely, you know, the market always goes for bigger phones, cheaper prices, bigger phones is kind of where we're going with it. So having a device that's actually smaller, I think is really neat. It definitely fits, you know, it's more niche. I mean, obviously Apple discontinued the mini for a reason. Sales were not doing great for that. The most recent one, I think the Zenfone 9, you know, is one of the most recent premium.
Phone.
Right. And they did it well. And it kind of like shows that you can still have a smaller form factor device that may be of interest to people. And I mean, I think the Kickstarter they're looking for 50,000 people right now for adoption. Like I could very well be one of them that throws some money in, because I would like to see that happen.
Sure. Yeah, I might do too. I think, you know, like I want it to be smaller, like iPhone size, because the Zenfone 9 is still bigger, right?
It's still like, big, 5.9, and this is like 5.4-ish, something like that.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So yeah, let's see how that works out. I'll link to a story in the show notes, folks. Last thing I want to touch with you on really quickly is Bard. Bard is now available to all of us. In fact, when you and I talked yesterday, I said, yeah, I got notified, but they asked me if I could join the waiting list. And guess what happened this morning? I got the actual email saying, you can try it out. So I haven't actually tried it out because I've been on an airplane. I haven't had time. But I want you to know that Maybe I'll have more on next week's podcast. The news here is that Bard is now available for you to try out. If you want to sign up for it, you might be put on a waiting list. But for me, the wait was only 12 hours. So, you know, you never know. And I don't think I got any special treatment here. Honestly, I don't think I'm even remotely on Google's radar beyond their Team Pixel group of people. So what's your take? Have you used it?
No, I haven't. I'm on the wait list, too, since it's been 26 hours as of now that I'm still on the wait list.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, let's reserve this discussion for the next time maybe you and I have a podcast together, because I don't really have much more to say because I haven't tried it. You neither. And it's mostly to let you know, folks out there, that yes, you now have another AI to scare you or impress you or please you or make you run for your lives out there. Who knows? Basically, yeah, that's kind of the news. We should wrap up. Do you want to tell folks where they can find you, Maurice, on the internet, your various social media handles on various services that you use? And I know they can find your writing on Counterpoint. There's some public stuff out there, but do you have any other projects you're working on?
No, not right now. You can basically find me at M. Klaehne on Twitter. That's M-K-L-A-E-H-N-E. It's a German name. It's harder in English. But find me on there. I'd love to discuss smartphones, anything basketball related. Let me know.
Do you do Instagram at all?
I don't really. It's more private for me.
On Instagram. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Cool. And so other than Counterpoint, is there any place else that people can find your writing and your work?
No, not right now. I'm mostly just quoted by you guys for quotes.
I know, it's kind of cool.
So it's different as an analyst, having the writing mostly quoted by the reporters or tech influencers. So, yeah.
Well, you know, I've had Anshel on the show multiple times, so I'm looking forward to having you on the show more times as well.
Yeah, no, would love to. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, let's make it happen. Folks, you know where to find me on the internet. I'm at Tankgirl. That's T-N-K-G-R-L. Like the comic book character Tankgirl. Just drop all the vowels. You know, back then in the mid-90s when I came up with this, I was like, oh, I'm such a rebel. Nobody can steal this handle from me. And then Flickr came along and they started dropping the vowels. And I'm like, you copycats. Anyway, that's my handle on Twitter, my handle on Instagram as well. If you want to chat with me and Maurice about this podcast, hit us up on Twitter. And, you know, if you want to see pretty pictures of phones, pretty pictures of cars, pretty pictures of, I don't know, travel, food, all that stuff, check out my Instagram. I take most of my photos with phones, which is kind of fun because maybe when I get this Oppo, I can show you what it can do. Right now, there's some photos out there on the Insta that I took with the 13, the Xiaomi 13 Pro. So check it out. There's also a couple of YouTube channels you can subscribe to, youtube.com/mobiletechpodcast and youtube.com/mobiletechmore. These are visual complements to the podcast. So if you want to watch me unbox the Realme 10 Pro Pepsi Edition, that's the latest phone that I've unboxed on the channel, on the main channel. And that's like really fun because it's like a Pepsi branded $300 phone from Realme. And the other channel, the More channel, is really basically just like all the non-direct connected to the phone thing. So like the main channel has the phones and the earbuds and, you know, maybe some things like tablets and wearables. But the More channel has the car stuff, the travel stuff, home automations, things like that. So subscribe, you know how YouTube works. Like, tell your friends, you know, and comment and click the little bell, you know the drill. The podcast itself lives at mobiletechpodcast.com. We're on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, everywhere good podcasts can be found. So please consider subscribing, telling your friends. If your app lets you review or rate the show, please do that. That would be awesome. And I've got another little treat for you. You probably heard me mention earlier about the Patreon. Patreon is where there's a bunch of extra stuff. And if you join, you help me financially, which really helps because, you know, got to pay the bills somehow. So consider joining Patreon. You can get a video version of the podcast. You get it a day in advance of the audio version and you get to see me and Maurice make silly faces and brandish phones. Exactly. You know, you're going to have to watch to see what Maurice did.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's other perks there you can get. Like, there's a Discord server you can join if you're a Patreon. There is, I'll let you explore. But check out the Patreon. And if you can support me on a regular basis through Patreon, I would really appreciate it. And then also, if you don't like Patreon, I get it. There's other options. There is a PayPal link in the show notes. You can click through the PayPal link and make a donation. You know, I love my coffee. So buy me a coffee for $5, whatever it is. Consider that as well. And I also want to thank our sponsor, Mint Mobile. So as you know, I'm constantly reviewing multiple phones. And while that's fun, it also means I'm constantly spending a lot of money for wireless service on multiple SIMs. That's where Mint Mobile comes in. And that's who I'm partnering with for today's podcast. If you also want to save money on your wireless service, switch to Mint Mobile. As tech-savvy early adopters, you've probably heard of Mint Mobile before, but let me quickly tell you how awesome their service is. Mint Mobile offers premium wireless for as low as $15 a month, and you don't have to sacrifice any coverage, speed, or data. They're built on the nation's largest 5G network. They keep costs low because they sell direct to you online. They cut out the retail stores and salespeople. Why should you pay more than you have to for access to the same network? In my experience testing phones, Mint Mobile delivers the same data speeds and call quality as the big three for a fraction of the cost. Switching to Mint is super easy. Thanks to their eSIMs, you can sign up and activate immediately right on your phone from the comfort of your home. No more standing around and waiting in line at a big wireless store. You can keep your current device and phone number and easily switch services. And if your phone isn't eSIM compatible, Mint will ship you a new SIM free of charge. All Mint Mobile plans include unlimited nationwide talk and text, lightning-fast 5G, and free mobile hotspot. Mint will show you how much data you use each month and recommend plans that save you money. Mint also offers a modern family plan that lets you set up a super affordable family plan with as little as two lines. Use my link mintmobile.com/mobiletech to get premium wireless starting for $15 a month. That's mintmobile.com/mobiletech. Stop paying more than you need on your wireless bill and start saving big with Mint Mobile. And I want to thank you, Maurice, for being my guest this week. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely, Miriam. Thank you so much.
Fantastic. Well, listen, it's been a great time. I'll have you on again at some point in the future. And folks, we will have another show next week. So stay tuned for that. Until then, cheers, everybody.
This has been the Mobile Tech Podcast with Tank Girl, proudly presented by worldpodcasts.com. You can visit us online at mobiletechpodcast.com.